So I was about to introduce us, but I only see familiar faces. Okay, there's someone who I don't know, so, and who doesn't know us. So I'm Jakub Steiner, and this is Tuomas Kuosmanen. We both work for Zimian, and we do the artwork. And essentially all our bitmap graphics is done in a free software package called the GIMP, which of course you probably have heard about before. And it's now approaching another major release, 1.4, after quite some time. So we're going to be showing you some stuff that you can do with the GIMP, and we're going to be using the development version, which hopefully will be stable enough not to crash while doing the demonstrations. I will have to fall back to the old GIMP for the animation section of the tutorial, because the GIMP animation package is not quite stable yet, so that would crash like in a nano. So I'll begin with, if I can undo all the stuff that Tuomas here set up.
Yes, hello.
Yeah, okay, and you put it.
Over to the image. And then,
oh yeah, right. Yeah. So what you see here is the new user interface, which is not dramatically different to the previous version, but you can see that we did some new icons for the toolbar. And there's some like really nifty things for setting up your work environment, because different people use the GIMP for different stuff. Like me and Tuomas usually work on really low resolution bitmaps. We do icons most of the time. And we're working on low resolution screens on notebooks, while other people may work on high-resolution screens, working on high-resolution photo images that they got from their digital cameras, or even scanned in high resolution. So the GIMP now has a way to set up your working session. Traditionally, the GIMP main window was the toolbar window, which you used to access all the major painting and modifier tools. And then you had a lot of floating windows for doing for accessing tool options and layers and channels and all the stuff that we're going to describe later on. So you could end up having a lot of screen estate being taken by floating windows. In GIMP 1.4, when it comes up, or this development version, you could dock the windows. So for example, if I would access the tool options, initially I would be given a dialog like this, which would, you know, if I would open up another window for layers, another one for channels and stuff like that, I would then end up having very little screen estate for the actual artwork. So what GIMP now implemented was docks. So you can take any floating window and dock it together into these little tabs. And you can see on some of the windows there's this horizontal line that enables you to dock some more windows as well. And while this is really useful, you wouldn't want to be doing that every time you launch up the GIMP. The GIMP stores the layout window, or layout of its windows and docks, in a file called GIMP Session RC, which you can find in your GIMP directory. So you can see that all the session info is stored there. Unfortunately, there's no GUI yet for like saving the session into different files and being able to access those so that you can set up your environment for working with icons, working on your notebook, so you can just easily like change it. But you can always, like, you need to quit GIMP first because it's being flushed when GIMP exits. You can always copy the session RC file to some other one and just use simple some linking trick to like create different sessions and have GIMP start up in a way that you can use it depending on your project.
So there's a command line switch for
I was saying simlink down, like even wallpapers. Right. Editing photos, session RC, and just simlink to the session RC file, session RC, which is in your GIMP directory. So that was docs and sessions. Another cool thing that the GIMP has is if you can take a look at the older GIMP, you can see that all the dialogues, even though I have no image open, if I would open something. You can see that the dialogues are quite big. Even if I would shrink the font size, you can still see that there's a lot of padding. All the buttons are quite wide. So there's been some work targeted towards making this more customizable. So for example, people who prefer, I actually use a custom style to make the toolbar smaller as well, so I'm going to just comment that out. If I find the information on this keyboard, there it is.
No? Nope.
There it is. So, again. Okay, so you can see that the default size of the icons is bigger than the one that you saw. So you can customize things like that using rather obscure GTKRC file, but you can also access some of the stuff of the user interface in GIMP preferences window. So you can, for example, have the preview, size of the preview thumbnails. See that interface navigation there and
well, you can actually change it on the layer dialog itself. It's easier
well,
there.
You probably have
like right click on the tab.
Yeah, preview size. Large.
So
okay.
If you need
that would like probably opening up the new window. So you can customize the size of the thumbnails. If, for example, you have a high resolution screen, you want the thumbnails to be bigger, while on a screen like a laptop, you would want them to be smaller. And also all the icons for toggling the visibility and locking the layers got smaller too. So it's like a minor change, but it helps a lot when you're using a low resolution screen.
Can you actually hear us, by the way?
Yes.
Well,
okay.
I want to back to. Okay, good.
Also, when working on a lower end computer, which we wouldn't recommend for doing graphics work, but anyway, you want to alter your photos and you still have a low memory computer, you may find turning off thumbnails completely quite useful, because they're being generated from the whole image window, and they're used quite often. So for example, they're being used in the navigation window, they're being used for previewing all the layers. So every time you would apply a filter to a layer, the thumbnail would need to be reconfigured again. So you may find that useful to be able to turn it off. If I can find that, I can turn it off the thumbnail somewhere completely. Okay, yeah. So instead of the thumbnails, you would get just a fixed map showing you the image window instead of a thumbnail. So that's quite useful as well. Another thing that people find very useful with GTK was dynamic assignment of shortcuts. So for example, if I would, I'm gonna do colors levels. I actually set it up already, so I'm just going to, okay. So in GIMP 1.2 or GTK 1.2, you would be able to reassign the shortcut really easily by just going to a menu option and just pressing the right key combination that you would like this functionality to be given shortcut to. I hope that didn't sound too much of a German sentence. But this introduced problems like clashing shortcuts, because you wouldn't know that this shortcut that you're assigning already was being used elsewhere in the program, so you just throw away the other shortcut and use that for the new functionality. So usually GTK 2 apps don't have that option being on by default. So in GIMP, the thing was solved by having a preferences option in the interface that says dynamic keyboard shortcuts. So you're allowed to access the same functionality by using by setting this preference on, and then you could assign. Oops, I didn't know that. A different shortcut, but I'm going to use the one that I had. This also was, the toggle was introduced because the GIMP now has, apart from shortcuts, also introduced access keys or so for example, the problem with shortcuts is that you essentially run out of keystrokes, because there's so many functions in GIMP that you can't really come up with unique combination of 250 keyboard shortcuts. So another way to access a functionality is using access keys, but I'm going to show you another thing that was introduced, and that's window.
Show menu bar.
Yeah, show menu bar. Which probably needs to be turned off here. Menu bar. So all the Windows folks that, or the newbie people who couldn't find where all the functionality is, because it was hidden in the right-click menu, context menu of the image window, would be complaining, why isn't there a window menu? So it is now, and you can see all the underlined letters. That's the fast access keys. So you can use Alt and, for example, Alt S to access the select menu. So all the items are accessible with a keyboard. Unfortunately, the items are not completely accessible yet, so you need to use cursor keys to get to certain functionality, but it's being worked on. So eventually, you would solve the problem with running out of shortcuts by remembering the access key. So we just remember a sequence of keystrokes. So for example, if I would know that I can access Gaussian blur by pressing Alt of F for filters, blur for the blur subsection, and then G for Gaussian blur, then I could like really quickly access that functionality.
It's also, actually, I first thought that it's, well, adding like a menu bar onto each window is a bad idea because, well, we usually work with smaller icons, so where the window is like really small, so it gets clipped off here. But actually, I think it's actually, I've been using it for a while, so I turned it on because it got introduced, and I really started to like it. I mean, it's a nice way because for some stuff you can access the filter menu right away here instead of like going really many.
Of course, you can still access the right or the
The
context
menu right
by
also.
I think it's Shift F10 to get there. Yeah, Shift F10.
Is that like the common GNOME component?
Yeah, it's some common thing.
Yeah.
So that was the access key management. Okay. Another thing that was introduced in the user interface area was a really simple function called save a copy. I mean, it may not sound like a kick-ass feature, but it saves a lot of time when you're working. We're going to show you that complex artwork usually requires to have not just a single layer image, but you usually have multi-layered image with layer masks, probably store some channels and have paths in there. So you really want to work or save your artwork in the native file format. But for example, when you're targeting the web, which the GIMP is being probably used the most for, then you want to save into the formats that are popular on the web or standardized on the web, which is PNG or JPEG or GIF if you wish. So when you're saved to those formats, you usually lose information because you either want to index the image to 8-bit color or you lose all the layers and stuff. But also, you probably have your native format file somewhere else than the actual web output. So in older GIMP you would be using the very nice GTK file dialog to browse to another location. Even if you were using the auto completion using the tab, it would be like, you know, you made a change. Okay, I forgot to change something, and then you would have to save that image to a different location. So save a copy essentially saves a lot of work because it keeps your original image intact, and it just like exports the file to the format that you choose without affecting your current directory or anything like that. So that's another like, user interface based enhancement of the new GIMP that saves quite a lot of time. So I'm gonna give room to Tuomas, who's gonna start actually showing you something about GIMP, and he's gonna start with a sample demonstration.
Yep. Let's see. So,
let me see where it's on the other
it's funny when the keyboard is here. Okay. So, well, that's the old one.
One second.
Okay.
Actually, I closed this one.
Okay, it's fine.
So it's in running.
Yeah, so we have some samples prepared here. One of the, I mean, people always complain about the GDK file selector, and like we've been trying to make a GNOME file selector for like maybe 5 years or something, but it's one of the nice things. This actually works with the stable GIMP also, like the current stable version is, let's see, that you can actually take a picture from with Nautilus, for example, and you can just drag it to GIMP. So that's pretty useful. And
whatever
it works.
Yeah, you can even take, let's see if we have
we don't have
a net here. But anyway, you can drag an image from Mozilla to the toolbox and it works. It uses wget to get the stuff. So eventually I'm trying to push them to use GNOME BFS for everything, so you can could also save to like SSH, whatever, to your web server or anything.
Of course, I forgot to tell you about another thing. The GIMP was one of the first applications that implemented free desktop work back about thumbnails. And because Nautilus was the second application, it's now really cool to be able to.
Oh, the BZ2 plugin was probably not compiled in.
Oh man, that's
well, I'll just need to
unzip all of this. Thank you. The two applications share the thumbnails, so even if there's no viewer or thumbnailer or I don't know, compressed GIMP files, then you can still see thumbnails in Nautilus because GIMP, when you save them with the GIMP.
So you see Nautilus, the XCF is now being thumbnailed here.
So that's another thing.
So they are compatible thumbnails.
So what was I going to talk about? Selections. So
yeah. Let me check what I was. I'll check.
There's
so
another thing.
We don't. We don't really.
Not really.
It's not important.
This single thing.
Yeah, but it's fine. Okay. It's fine. So the one of the things that is sort of like advanced or takes a bit to learn, it's many of the graphic applications, even for Macintosh like Photoshop or Illustrator or Windows or whatever, they use keyboard modifiers a lot. Like when you do selections, like the rectangle. And then if you do a modifier key, like if you press Control, you see there's a little minus sign showing up. I wonder if it's visible or not. But
well, you can at least in the tool options dock, you can see the mode of the selection tool changes from just the
You see here on the dialog. So if you use like Shift, it makes a perfect square, and if you use
make sure that you know what selections are for, you actually usually want to work on just a part of the bitmap and not affect anything else. So there's a couple of selection tools that enable you to select an area. The really simple ones are the rectangular tool that Thomas is now showing you. But even with simple selection tools like the rectangular tool or elliptical tool, you can create complex selections by combining them or cutting from an existing selection, etc. So Thomas is.
So if you press Shift, you can add to the selection. It's like the logical operations. So Shift will add, and then Control will subtract from your current selection. So you can cut out shapes, or you can cut out like a, let's see, for example, a hand-drawn shape here. So this is, it takes a little to master, but these are really useful things because you can think of the selections, like if you know how people are drawing with like a conventional airbrush, they use this masking film. So they have their canvas or whatever they draw to a, like a car door, they use the airbrush. So they put this masking film there and then they cut out a shape, like, for example, well, I can actually show you. So if you want to do like a sphere, you put a selection here and then you take the airbrush, well, here. You take a big fuzzy brush and then you start, let me take some other color, so it's going to be red. So then you use it, the selection like mask, and you start filling it with color. So that's, it's pretty much the same like what you would use with a real airbrush, but you just use it, do it digitally with the selections, and then you can do a darker color. And like, of course, you would do it pretty much not in a rush like this, but anyway. So these selections are pretty useful for many things. And then you can like do another one. One of the nice things with the new GIMP is that if you are making a selection and you want to do, you want this shape, for example, but you noticed, oh shit, it's like too much on the left. So you can press the Alt key and then you can just move the selection as you're making it. And when it's in the right spot, then you release the key and you can continue to move it around. So that's
this function alone is worth, you know, using GIMP Unstable, because
this is really nice. I mean, you used to do it like, ah, crap, undo, and then try again.
And then you can move it, the whole selection, but then you can't grow it because, for example, you know, you realize, okay, it was one pixel off, but it was also, you know, 2 pixels.
So you would go like undo, redo, try again, undo. So this, just pressing Alt and moving the whole thing, whoops, not like that, is really useful. So let's see, this is so different than my current setup.
But just feel free.
Yeah, I need to do the mandatory aqua trick. Well, it's not that good.
Yeah, you get anyway. Like, yeah, shape.
Yeah, but anyway, you get the idea of selections. So.
So actually, I might just point out.
Who's talking?
Okay, you're talking too, but
right. Just go ahead.
A common like confusion with selection is that the shortcuts or the key modifiers work differently before you start the drag and after you start the drag, because when you use the modifier key before you start actually creating a selection, that it affects the mode of the selection tool. So you can either, if you press shift, it will be the selection that you're going to create, it will be added to the current selection, or you use control to subtract, and you use shift and control to create an intersection with the existing selection. But after you start dragging, the same keys have got different functionality. If you press shift, it will constrain the axis of the selection, so when you would be using an elliptical selection tool, it would do circles. If you would do rectangular ones, you would get squares. I think it's Alt or Control, would constrain or start creating the selection from the center, so you wouldn't like define top left and drag to bottom right corner, but you would do it symmetrically from the center. So that's the same modifier keys, but you know, it depends on when you press them or release them.
And you can also, if you're, I mean, in the beginning they're really confusing, so you can use these buttons here to like, instead of pressing the keys, well, they're actually pretty good visual cues also, like, if you don't remember which key does what, you see the buttons get switched there anyway. out. I can just move the whole thing. So that's really nice. Now I'm going to do the C trick. There's some. Okay, now it looks more like a shiny thing.
What was I doing?
Yeah. Yeah, there are, so there are many more, like the rectangular, like the basic ones are, and then there's the freehand, which you can basically use to just cut out any shape you want, but it's, of course, depends how stable your hand is. Then there's the magic wand, which basically does it based on the luminosity of the image. So you can select if you have like a image with uniform color, like a, well, for example here the background. You just click here and it will select the background. So this is useful for photographs which have like a uniform, like a blue sky, if you want to select that.
And it's a continuous area. So if you would have like a hole in the cut a hole in the
yeah. Let's see. Here and I'll just do like here and then fill with foreground color, so it's white, and select none. Whoop. Well, it's just none there.
Yeah. So if you would use the tool, it would only select the continuous area, so it wouldn't select the outer color. Yeah, it wouldn't have like the outer area because it's only the continuous area. It's like, you know, flexibility.
But you can also use the modify key here, so I can press shift and then it adds to the already selected. So I click on the both of them. What else do we have? Then we have the select by color, which is basically you select a color in the image and it searches the same color all over the place.
It's the same thing as the magic wand, except it doesn't work on the continuous areas.
So it just looks around the whole image and finds, like if you have a like a picture of a tablecloth which is like checkerboard, you just click one red checker and you will find them all. So the selection tools are really useful for different things. Then there's this actually, I want to demo this with another image.
We're showing you those because, you know, you really need to, you always use selections when you're working with digital images, you know, no matter what you do.
So here's a free advertisement for an airline, but anyway. So this is an example image. Let's see. Just resize a bit. So then you have the intelligent scissors or whatever these are called. This is a pretty handy tool if you want to cut out shapes because it looks up for certain contrast lines on your image. So if you click here and then for example here, it will try to find you sort of like the approximation. So it's not always really accurate, but this is really quick way to find out like cut out shapes. So if you want to, so you can guide it a bit, like you click, and if it gets it really wrong, you can just add a point here. And like this. So basically, this is a quick and rough way to find out stuff. And then you click on the little selected. Or then there's, let me see, that's the end of the selection tools. And also there's the path tool. It's like, this is basically the most powerful one, which is using the Bezier curves. So you can do, this is a bit in development still, but the current 1.2 game has a working version. Yeah. Well, I don't have to. I mean, I can. Yeah. This works enough now, so it's getting usable. So basically you define curves, and these are nice and anti-aliased and everything. So if you want to...
What was this going to demo that for a photo retouching session which is going to follow?
Yeah, we're showing the boring stuff first.
Yeah.
So we'll see. If you like stand us for a while, we'll get to the cool stuff soon. So basically you define the curves and then you make it to a selection, and then like you can do, let's see, like you can colorize this part here somehow. So the idea of the selections is that if you don't want to have some kind of effect on the whole image, you use the appropriate selection tool to select part of the image and then work on it. Like whether it is like just using the drawing tools or whatever. So it only works on that selected area. So it helps you to not spill the airbrush. It won't paint outside the part. Or if you want to, for example, adjust contrast on photographs, you may want to select some particular area which has a problem. Let's see. There's also a useful thing many of you might know, that you can... Actually, let me open a different image for that. Here is one image. That's a lamppost from the city.
Is it? It's a lot of light here.
Yeah, it's really dark in the monitor here. I'm like, can it be the same image? Anyway, so you can drag guides here. So if you click on the ruler and drag, you get this guideline, which is pretty close. There's a bug. So you can drag this, for example, here, and another one here, to if you want. For example, we want to select this ellipse-shaped area of length. So we drag these guides exactly to the edge.
Of course, this is a workflow that's not really necessary these days when we have the dynamic movement of when
creating. Well, let me show that. Yeah. So this is like, which is a good way to select an area, because you like restrict the corners and then the selection will snap with that. So you can pretty much find it like ellipsis shape here. Of course, with the, this is like how I used to work, but with the new selection tool, I can pretty much do an ellipsis selection, for example, here. Just press Alt and move it around. This seems to be a bit slow machine. Yeah, of course, yeah, it snaps to the grid. Or to the... Something is... Maybe the machine is a bit slow. Anyway. So that works too. But like, you can, again, use the Alt key to move it around. Yeah. Anyway, it's a bit off, but anyway, you get the basic idea. And then you can do like something weird here. Like, whatever. I mean, it depends on what you want to do, but the selections are a important thing to know. So you can cut things out of some image and paste them to another or whatever. Let's see.
Let me just quickly jump in.
Yeah.
All the selections that we created here have sort of a sharp edges. And you can see the lamp here. If you would want to like take the lamp out of this background, you can see that the borders are kind of fuzzy. So what you can do is there's a function called feather. So in the selection menu.
Select feather.
Feather, which will like... soften the edges of the selection. So while you can't really see...
Well, let me fit it more so you see.
So while you can't see it on the selection preview, it actually, you know, the selection is fuzzy in the edges. Yeah, like that. When we're going to talk about masks and relation between masks and
so you see
selections, you will see that.
It takes a bit of the fuzziness. Sometimes you want to make a smooth cut.
Yeah.
It looks better on. Depends on the situation all the time. So we get to more of that in the practical examples. Yeah. So then the one of the good things with the GIMP is the layers. I think it's one of the hardest things to actually figure out at first. Like,
yeah,
it was, the concept is kind of like, it was hard for me originally to, like, it just clicked at some point and then I understand what the idea was. But basically, we created here a nice sphere, and now if we would want to change something, like the color of the ball or something, it would be hard because everything is painted on top of the other things. So layers, what you could do is, let me duplicate this image and clear it. So let me do the same with layers. So we make a new layer here and we make a new selection. Again with shift so we get this nice round shape. And we take the airbrush. And we have this nice huge brush here. Let's see, I want to add the palettes here. So I get some nice color.
So while Thomas is doing that, the concept is basically similar to like having films of, this is a raster editor, and you would want to like work with parts of the image as objects, you know, being able to like move the sphere after a while without having to repaint what's below it. You know, like a flat image on a single layer, you would move the sphere and then suddenly a hole would appear below it. So layers are sort of a workaround of the fact that this is not a vector editor, but you're working with bit maps. So you're actually having like films of or layers of artwork. So when you move some film in the stack, you still have the artwork below it, so it doesn't show nothing, it shows what is below it.
So for example here, I have this, there are now three layers. The background, which is the white, you can turn it off, on and off here on the dialog. And then there's this layer which just has the violet sphere. And then we have one new one which is still empty. So if I want to colorize it, I'll take the white color and the airbrush. Take this selection back and start painting on it. So we now get this kind of...
Without saying, Thomas actually used a function called alpha to selection, which takes all the non-transparent pixels or the alpha information and creates that into a selection. So for example, you could have used the ellipse tool or the select by color tool to create to get the shape of the circle that you created, but it's easier to just use alpha to selection and just get the object.
So now I renamed this layer. So basically what I have here is there's just the highlight. And the other layer has the background color and then the background like this. So if I want to like reposition it, I'll remove the selection and use the move tool. So I can move just the highlight here without actually moving this part. So if I want, I can
paint with like a normal paintbrush over, like add some orange here, paint here. So you'll see it happens on this layer. Or if we want, we don't want to destroy that, we can add just another one here in between and like scribble on that one. I'll take some funny brush here. Well, papers, it's gonna be crazy. So you can put stuff here, and even if you don't, if you later find out that, oh, that really sucks, it ruins our nice image, so you can then just delete this layer and the image is not being destroyed. So that's kind of the idea of layers. It's basically fundamental to graphic design. You do everything with layers because then you can later go back and fix things. You can, for example, we do for icons, for the MIME type icons, for like you have this PDF file, so there's this paper sheet image that's on its own layer, and then we have this MIME type symbol, so we kind of can reuse the same. If we want to do a new MIME type icon, we just open an existing XCF file of an icon and then just delete the PDF symbol there and draw something new. So we can reuse parts of images much easier. So if we want to do, let's say, a shadow here, we copy this layer, so we now have two copies of the same one, and we drag it below here. So it works like a stack of transparent films. You can also make it keep transparency, so if you draw, it doesn't touch on the transparent areas, so then it's easy to like select all and fill with black. So now we have the same thing, but it's black, and now we can use Gaussian blur here to create some fuzziness. Whoa, that's too little. So we can do. This, and then if we again move this layer, you can also move with the cursor keys here. So you see the yellow black dotted line is actually the layer border. So each layer has its own size. So we can put it like this and we get a nice shadow. So this is basically how you can work with the layers. So you build your image like stack by stack. I think like the artists who work with oil paints, they do it sort of like this way too, like you paint something and then you let it dry and then you start adding stuff on top of that, and then you have to let the paint dry again, otherwise you end up with just, I mean, I tried to use oil paints when I was younger and all I could come up with was like a brown mess because it always got mixed up with the old ones, so I didn't have the patience to let it dry.
Silvio artwork is probably the new art gallery here.
I don't know. But yeah. So basically you build on top of things, and then once you're done, like if you want, then you do a image, flatten image, and that removes the layers. So once you're finished, and then you save it as a JPEG or whatever. And that's when the, like Jakob said, the save a copy is handy because you don't have to like flatten your current image and accidentally save it. So as the XCF, then the layers are gone.
Masks and layers.
Yeah. So mask is nice too. Basically, it's like you can lock the layer transparency, so you can add the layer mask, and GIMP asks what you want to do with it. So I say I want to use the current alpha channel, which I already have, so it has the round shape. So I'll add that. And it basically adds a black and white layer here, which defines, like, if this pixel here is transparent or not. So if it's white, it's like opaque, and the black parts are transparent. So what is good about this is that you can take, for example, a photograph. Let's see. Here. Let's get, for example, this one. So I can actually take a picture here, select part of it, copy, and I can paste it here. I select this layer and edit, paste. So it pastes it inside that shape because the layer mask actually defines where you can see through and where you can't. So you can put it here, you can move it around if you want, or whatever. And you anchor it here. So basically you see here, let me make it use... Yeah, I'm gonna do that. If I make it bigger, you see here, the actual image is here, but you only see half of it, like the shape, because the mask defines it. And if you control click here, it will disable the mask for you if you want to see how it looks without or with the mask. Or if you want to, what's it, Control-Alt-Click shows you the mask only. So then if you want, you can play with it here, like change the mode, papers, whatever. You can change to some same brush here. So you can edit it here, and then if you so it will, you can play with the mask and it will change the shape.
Of course, you could even cut the actual object on the layer, but this is a non-destructive change, because when you're using the mask, you can always throw the mask away and still have the original artwork on the layer. So masks are useful for, like, you know, doing non-destructive change of the object on the layer.
It's useful, for example, if you make, let's say you have a website to make and you want to make like navigation buttons, and each of them you want to have this nice photograph as a background. So you can define, like, if you want to have different photos like this, so you have to do the highlights and everything only once, and then you can just take another, like, this, you can take another image from here, for example. So this would be, these are like example photos for the next stuff. So you can copy from here and paste here again on the layer. So you paste. So you see it's the same shape again, but you get a new image. So it's easy to, like, you do the highlight and whatever only once, and then you can reuse the same layered image all over to do with, like, you get many different images with the same work. So if we do duplication, here's our blue sphere, and here's our the other one. So you get the idea, you can reuse the same shapes again. You can even do things like filters, let's see, distorts, there was probably a whirl and pinch. Well, this would be the one, so we put 0 for the whirl, and then we can do stuff like this so it looks more like a sphere. Well, it's a bit different shape, but anyway, you get the idea. So you have this layer mask, so it always stays the shape, gives the same shape.
What are we doing?
Layer mask.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, the layers can have different modes too, but it's like these are things you take the GIMP and you play with them, you'll see what happens. Like different things do.
Actually,
you can have like. Well,
yeah, I'm gonna show you some of the useful layer modes later on when we're gonna talk about photo touch up. So I'm gonna show you how you can use it. Those are the ways that the upper layers are being applied to the stack below them. So you don't have just a simple, you know, if you have a pixel with full opacity, then it would cover all the pixels below it. So you have a special overlay modes that would do something, you know, different than just.
It's like you apply colored filters on your on the stack of images or whatever. So it's.
It just should work on the color.
Yeah.
Eyes.
It's easier to show with like practical examples, which we're going to do later. Let's see. Then I'm gonna do a simple example for. Let me close this and this. So you're going to show the web stuff.
Yes.
So I'll do a simple mockup here. So let's say we have 640 and. Page could be longer, so let's say 600 is fine. So we make this simple and nice website mockup.
So from what I've heard from people, GIMP is primarily used for website graphic editing and for digital pictures editing. So basically we're going to show you practical examples doing a website mockup and how you like cut up the mockup into actual pieces of artwork or images. And then we're going to show you there's going to be a section on photo editing later on. So Thomas is starting to
I'm basically laying out a simple website template here. So you think, here's like the navigation bar, here would be the title, and maybe some like top level navigation bar here, which is pretty typical for websites today. Like when you look at the GUEDEX site, we have this top bar and stuff on the left and like that. So very often I do it like this. So I do it with selections. Let me make this preview size really small. I make a new layer again for different things, so it's easier to move things around later. So I'll make a selection. So I define the size like you see here is like, for example, 180. It's a nice even number. So it's easier to work with the HTML later. So with the rectangle tool, this will snap to the grid, so it's easy to select things. Let's see here. For example, here. Then I can. Where was my palette? Here. It's getting a bit too big. So I want this to be, let's say, dark brown. And then I select here for the other part. And I drag a little lighter color here. And then I select, let me make it a bit smaller. Just colorize things here. based on the color. I want to have like a nice purple top color here. So with the snap to grid, it's pretty easy to do. You can turn the guides off if you want. Let's see, we want to move this part of it. Copy and paste. And move it around. So this is the basic groundwork for like laying out things. And then we can fix here too. Keyboard is a bit weird for me. And then anchor it back. So we basically now have the different basic colors defined here on one layer. Then we take another layer, and if we want to add a logo for like...
Okay, that's another tool that's been completely reworked.
Yeah, the text tool is getting really nice lately. It uses free type now, so you get nice anti-aliased fonts and everything.
Yeah, it uses Mango actually. And it's gonna have, like, you can see that it's not exactly on canvas editing, but you can see the preview of the text.
Yeah, this is really work in progress, so it's gonna get a lot better.
Yeah, the really cool stuff that is gonna be in June 1.4 is that you will be able to define rectangles of text, and it's gonna reflow word wrap the text within the frame, which is especially useful for I don't know, website mockups, because you just define an area where you want some text and some space and full art text. Word wrap into the area, so you know when you're doing mockups, you don't really do content, you just want to have some fluid text. And so although you can do multi-line text right now, you just like crop it or do it, chop it off manually, which is while you have really nice automatic word wrap and give 1.4.
So basically lay out things here. It's gonna be a really cheesy website, quick hack, whatever.
And of course, all the text is editable later, and it's gonna be saved. It's not at the moment, but it's gonna be saved within the file.
Yeah.
And later on, open it and like edit it.
Whoops, wrong year. So let's see, like that. Look into the future. So basically, let me add a little. So I'm gonna copy this and keep friends, and then I'm gonna fill it with some dark color. And I'm gonna reach the one made a little bit larger. And then I'm gonna use blur, go some blurs in this here, take off the keep trends. So we get a nice shadow here. Is it visible at all? Maybe it's a bit. And then we move this a bit up. Now.
Unfortunately, we don't have the newest Tango installed, so some of the stuff like turning off and aliasing probably doesn't work.
We'll see. Well, yeah, you can like switch between the different hinting and whatever. And also,
it's
like
Tango batches is now. screens.
Yeah, you can. It's getting pretty nice. So that's the point. Like, it used to be pretty curvy, but it's really work in progress, but it's getting very nice. So we're going to have a nice text tool. So let's see. I'm gonna move this. Whoops. Not that one, but.
Oh, there's another cool thing. Usually, when you're doing mockups like this, you keep selecting the move tool all the time, and then go back to your previous tool, like we, you know, edited text, and then we wanted to move it a bit, and then go back to the text tool, same stuff. There's a quick, like a toggle, when you press spacebar, regardless of your selected tool performance, you just select some kind of tool, and then if you press and hold spacebar, you get the move tool, and you move the stuff around, when you,
and then you can
stop
when you go back.
Spacebar, it goes back to the previous tool, so that's a simple thing, but it saves a lot of time when you position stuff while you're ready.
Verisons, one of the nice donated fonts from GNOME. So let's see, it's getting there. So I'm gonna make these into nice layer boundaries as duplicate and filters burr. It's probably one of the most useful plugins ever made for anything like blur. Okay, like real men would use just text for the menu, but I'm just showing off the game, so I'll keep some nice drop shadows and everything. Okay, so here we have like a really basic shape for a website.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna we'll continue from here to like show how you would actually use it for, like, go on from here to get it onto your website.
Actually, I'm just gonna do a side jump, but then
yeah.
Go on from here. So you have the multi-layered mockup, and you want to target the web. So there's two formats that you want to use. It's either JPEG, which uses lossy compression but can handle 24-bit color images, while there's PNG, which is suitable for like line art, something like what we have here, unlike JPEG, which is suitable for photographs. So PNG is more suitable to stuff like this. But you probably wouldn't want to use RGB PNGs on the web yet. Maybe in America, because they got plenty of bandwidth, or here in the university. But we're from the lower developed countries, so still in modems. So you would want to use indexed color, so up to 8-bit color information. So how to do that? GIMP would automatically, if you would just, you know, want to save an image. I mean, I have a sample image prepared somewhere. Okay, we have web index.
It's BC2 again. So you drag it to the drag it to the terminal.
We probably have
file
roller.
Yeah, we have.
Ta-da. Okay. And this one.
Okay. I push the same.
Okay, well, that's probably the one.
Yeah.
No. So.
No. File portal.
Yeah. Not really. Well, okay. I thought it's.
Oh, that explains. Brightness is set to -80 on the monitor. Okay. It was a bit dark.
Yeah, so it actually was the first image, but you know, it looked completely different to me. So I had to boost the brightness here. So I have a sample artwork that is perfectly suitable for indexing the color, because using JPEG would bring in some artifacts on the edges especially. So JPEG really is good for photographs only. So before exporting or saving to PNG, I would want to index the color information. Of course, when using Save a Copy, GIMP would use, and you know, exporting, for example, this RGB image to a GIF format, which can't be RGB, it would ask whether you want to export the image first, and would use the last settings of the index functionality, indexing functionality. So once, if you would be doing this for multiple images, you could just, you know, save as, and GIMP would ask, okay, do you're saving to a format that can't handle RGB? Yeah.
Just curious, are there more formats coming?
There's not like, you know, dramatic increase of file formats. There's better support for Photoshop PSD files in terms of importing paths and
well, you can import SVG now.
And also, yeah, the PSD export or file handler now handles export as well, so you can save to PSD. There was a plugin available externally, but it's now in the core. And also for, I'm going to talk about animations. So not only you can save to GIF, which I don't think that the patent expired already. Yeah. It's going to expire. It did? Okay. Well, but there's, you still have the chance to use the okay, MNG format, which is,
yeah,
which is
like
the movable network graphic, which is like the PNG for animations, so that's another file format addition.
And I think GIF is not going away anyway, so
yeah.
I mean,
well, yeah,
the Internet Explorer is not supporting PNG, right, still, so it's, you just have to use GIF if you're targeting the generated audience.
So I'm coming back to indexing the image. So there's multiple ways how you can lower the color information. You can either use a custom palette. You saw that Tuomas was working with a set of colors, which is called a color palette. And you can use a particular palette to be used for an image. So for example, if I would pick up the Zimian icon palette, you can see that only the colors within the palette were used.
Maybe you want to zoom in a bit.
Okay.
So it's going to be this one.
Yeah, so you can see. Also, I'm going to just fold back and pull back. There's methods of dithering, which, for example, if I would use no color dithering, you could see a lot of banding. For example, on the monitor, you can see there's like four steps of color, and it's quite distracting. So there's a way to dither between those four colors, so it, to a human eye, it appears like a gradient of many colors, although it is still just the four. And there's multiple methods of dithering, so that's another thing that you can define. Also, if you have an image with alpha information, so for example, if I would toggle the background,
maybe it's
this one. Yeah. Okay. So if I would have like this image only, I probably have to flatten it first. So I can well, there is a little shadow in here, so with words. So if I have a transparent area and I have some semi-opaque pixels, like the one below the computer, there's a bit of shadow, I can choose to dither those pixels to because GIF or index PNG, well, index PNG actually does support alpha as well, but the implementation safe export that includes Internet Explorer, which still can't handle advanced PNG transparency, requires to use just a single bit transparency. So it's either opaque, the pixels either opaque or it's transparent. So if you choose this, then you can make GIMP dither the pixels. It kind of isn't too good, but you can make it like dither to the alpha channel, to the transparent areas like that. Of course, there are situations like this one where if you choose to do no dithering, for example, I would want this image to be really small, so I wouldn't be using 255 colors. I would just say, okay, I want to use just 64 colors.
Well, like,
so the palette.
16.
Well, no, that's extreme example.
Yeah.
64 colors, and
so
I would use no color dithering. It would create a nice flat area for the single colored background, but the monitor would have the banding, which sucks. So I wouldn't want to do that. Then I would have option to do like Floyd Steinberg color dithering, which works pretty well on the monitor. The gradient looks a lot better. Well, you have it enlarged, but it looks kind of okay for the actual screen, but it totally sucks for the background area, because it was a single color and you can see dithering and it's like, you know, there's like pixels randomly appearing and it really sucks. So you could like manually, because you can still work with images in the index color mode, but you know, some of the filters wouldn't be available, etc., etc. But you could, like, you know, for example, start painting, you know, with the pen tool. Of course, you have to have some same brush. So if I would be painting blue, I could, like, you know, fix it manually, but you can see it would be a lot of work. So there's a neat trick. We showed you one of the selection tools was select by color. So I would pick the background first with the tool. Perhaps lowering the threshold a bit.
Well, actually, the magic one would work just fine.
Yeah. Okay. So like that. And I use the color picker tool to select the current color to be the background color. And then I would go to the indexing functionality, color indexing, and I would use Floyd Steinberg dithering, which would get me this ugly background dithering. But I would just use edit fill with foreground color and end up with a good, nice, oh, froze.
Whoa! What happened?
I have no idea.
Whoa!
Oh, it went to sleep. I thought we were powered.
Control A, or function A.
That's the fun part again.
That's a funny machine.
So could it be that we were uncolored?
in the power.
Yeah, for sure.
And we are even, yeah, the power supply is what says powered.
This is like, okay,
it's getting interesting. We'll just reboot it.
Well, that's what I'm trying to do.
So this was a planned break for you to be able to get some drinks and stuff. I do control A, you go back, or enter the
control. Okay.
Okay, so I need to make sure. I want to do control shift A, not function shift A. So I want to control A. So I get a combination of the two methods. I have a solid black background and I have a desert monitor. So that's the way how it works for images where you want, you know, both of the
dithering and
dithering, yeah, and flat areas. JPEG. The GIMP JPEG export, actually I don't think it's a very new feature, but it gives you, if you export to JPEG file, say the copy for example, it gives you a,
whoa,
it would give you a preview. Okay, it's a development version. So you can like tweak all the, because you know, you're targeting the web, so you want your images to look good but to be small. So you can tweak the settings compression ratio, and then you can even apply blur before exporting so that the JPEG compression works better. It just depends on what kind of compromise you want to do in terms of file size and quality of the output. Another thing I wanted to show you was image maps. I'm not sure I'm going to go into much detail. Of course, we need to what examples led image map. So, well, I could actually work on this image. I could if it didn't crash and got lost. So, image maps, usually these days, are handled as client-side image maps, so your browser interprets a markup that defines areas of an image, so you can have hyperlinks to various URLs from within a single image, and while you could only use your regular text editor and just pick up the
coordinates
of individual points, because you can define primitive areas like rectangles, ellipses, or the most useful is probably the polygon. So you could define that, for example, this is a sample image of a golf course, so you would want each hole to point at a different document. So I would define polygons to, for example, if the user would click on this anywhere on this hole, he would be taken to a page about this particular golf course hole. So you would just, you know, write down, okay, I'm going to start a polygon from 267 to 25, and another point of the polygon would be the one shown at the lower end corner of your image window. But the GIMP also includes a powerful image map editor, which is hidden under filters and web. And it works like a standalone application, so we can define areas just by clicking, and so I can define the polygon, and it probably works a lot faster than just figuring out the coordinates of individual pixels. And then it writes down the markup for you, so you can even, there's preferences, so you can have client-side image maps, which is probably the only thing that's being used
these days.
Those were like server-side, the client would only send a coordinate of where the user clicked, and the server would have to deal with that. So this image map editor would do all the stuff for you, and it's got a really nice GUI, and you can save the map, of course, and then either use it as a just cut and paste the parts, and you can do that also, like if it was a complex image map, and you could load it up back and work on it further. So that's image maps. Another solution to the same problem is splitting the image into segments. So for example, Tuomas created this little nice image that I could have used, but it sort of
vanished.
So I'm gonna use this. So for example, I could be using the crop tool to crop or cut along the guidelines. So there's this right. Yeah, so it's the crop tool, and it sticks to the guides, so it's really simple not to use, like, it would be pretty common to use the same area on two pixels and the whole thing would shift by one pixel and redo the whole thing again, so guides help there. Also, there is a functionality that might go somewhere else than I'm used to, which was slicing the whole image along the guides.
Transform
the angular tool. So GIMP would like cut the image into individual parts and you would be able to save it. Why would you want, there's also a Perl script that would also generate, that would save all those files automatically to whatever format you would choose and generate an HTML page that links, but that's only in GIMP 1.2 because the Perl bindings were not ported yet and it was written in Perl, so you need to wait for that. Why would you want to have this done manually? Well, because for example on the page that on the mock-up that Thomas showed, there would be like a part of a photograph below the menu or something that would be really useful to be saved as JPEG because of the characteristics of the image, while the rest would be perfect to be saved as PNG, so you could like have this part to be saved as JPEG and all the rest to be as PNGs. Of course, if you've seen Photoshop, they have some really nifty guides that you can even define areas to be saved at a particular format, so we'd like to have that in the GIMP, but it's not there yet. So that's guides. Another. And now I'm gonna do the first fun thing to show you, which is animations. Because what kind of animations? We're talking about the web, so usually, apart from doing graphic elements for your website, you also want to advertise your website, of course, using banners. So the GIMP can help you there. I am, however, going to be using, for the simple functionality, I'm going to show you it in the development version, but then there's something called GAP, GIMP Animation Plugins, and it's very unstable in the current development branch, so that wouldn't be fun to be waiting after the thing crashes. Crash. So animations. Another cool thing that I didn't show you was that we have templates. So when you create a new image, you can have preset dimensions of documents. So for example, GIMP ships with presets for creating banner images. So for example, I would select the really common size of the web banner. You can easily save any size and even define an icon for it by using the GIMP's stock system, but I'm not gonna show you everything. You just save any type of image as template and it will only save the dimensions of the image and you then associate an icon with it. So we have a simple image like this, and while Tuomas showed you layers to be used for compositing a static image, the GIMP also can use layers as a storage for frames of an animation. It's the simple, like I told you that there's an advanced way of doing animations with the GIMP, which I'm going to talk about later. This is the really simple one. So if you have a really simple banner that you want to do, just it will have some static graphic, and you want to have some text being shown at an interval of 1 second. So I'm gonna show you how to do a simple animation like that. So we'll have us there. Hopefully I will have some artwork for the simple animation. Okay. And I'm gonna cheat a little.
Okay. Yeah.
So I'm just gonna use the gradient tool to create this little nifty background. We have the palette somewhere. So I'm gonna select the gradient from blue to a dark blue. I'm a bit colorblind, so purple, blue, same thing. And I'm gonna use a linear gradient, but I'm gonna do a bilinear one because I want just to have a like a highlight in the middle and it goes to the dark and blue. That's another cool thing. Although you can click on the gradient button in here and select the gradient that you want, you can actually use your mouse wheel to quickly access the gradient that you want. So I'm going to use a gradient which is from the foreground color to the background color, and I'm going to go from the center to the sides. You can constrain
the angle
by holding shift and control. And then I'm gonna do a little border around the image. So I'm gonna select the whole. I'm gonna use the item so you can see what I'm doing. I'm selecting the whole area. I'm filling it with black. And I'm shrinking the selection by 1 pixel. And then I'm cutting. Clear. So I end up, you can see that was another thing that was quite annoying in GIMP 1.2, which was you see the border of the layer, which is the yellow black dotted lined dashed line, and then you have the selection boundary, so you don't really see that we actually stroked the whole image with black, while in GIMP 1.2 you could hide both, so you wouldn't see the layer boundaries or the selections. In GIMP 1.4 you'll be able to actually toggle them independently. You know, sounds simple, but I was praying for that feature for quite a while. So I'm gonna hide the selection and I'm gonna hide the layer boundary. So you can see I created a small little border.
Really visible. Like okay, there's like back 1 pixel black outline.
Okay, so let's do this. I keep hitting functions, so I hope I'm not going to crash the machine again. And then I have a few images like that. Oh, actually, probably. Let me try. I never tried.
Nope.
Okay. So it doesn't work. And I have a little penguin that I'm gonna mate on. Yeah. Okay. So I have. So this is the static part of the banner. I have this template, and I want it to say. I wanted to say something like this is like that. And I want to center this, so I'm gonna use a layer, line visible layers, and this is a bit like not very nicely laid out dialogue, so I want to use collect, center, collect, center, and use the baseline. Whoops. Controls. Set, command, use. Is there on here? Was there on here? Okay. Control F. Yeah, so I sent you that. So I have an image that is like the first frame of our animation. But unfortunately, I need to discard the... I'm gonna duplicate the image so that if I screw up eventually, then I can go back. So I'm gonna do image duplicate. And I'm gonna merge this image into a single frame, because we're working with a simple animation, and in each layer of the animation will be a frame of the final animation. So I'm gonna do image, flatten image, okay. I'm gonna get rid of that. So then I can use this cheat a little again, and I'm gonna do this banner will. Oops. This banner will. Okay. I'm gonna duplicate that as well. And I'm gonna flatten that image, flatten, and put it in here. So if I there's a filter that can preview what I've done so far, which is in filters, animation, and there's animation playback. So we have only two frames, but it already works. But we want to define the delay between each frame, or how long the frame will be shown. So we use the actual, we'll call it frame one, this will be frame two. So the layer name is, it's kind of a hack, because you can use the layer name for specifying the delay. So I'm gonna use a second delay, which is 1,000 milliseconds, and the other one as well. 1,000 milliseconds. So when I preview it again, filters animation playback, it's gonna play back. Another cool feature is that you can drag this playing back animation and put it, like, for example, on the on a different web space and you know, see it how it will work.
That's really handy, on like the final image. Design a banner for a specific site.
Yeah, so you will see.
You can just drag it there and see if it works.
Yeah, okay. And now we're gonna do something a little more nice. I'm gonna duplicate this, flatten it, image, flatten, put it in here, so we get, call it pause, and then half a second, and we're gonna use some penguins that I prepared before, like that. Okay, so
one friendly catch penguins.
Yeah. I'm gonna duplicate this layer multiple times. You can call it so let's have like five wins. And move the last one. Whoops. So what I want to do is I want like a progress bar made of penguins so that they're going to show up from left to right. I'm going to use the same dialogue or same feature as I've used for centering the text, which is called Align Visible Layers. So I have all the penguins visible, and I'm not going to do anything vertically, so I'm going to choose none, and I'm going to fill from left to right. Actually, from right to left, although we want them to go from left to right, but this filter works from the upper layers downwards for some reason. So I'm gonna do right to left, and I'm gonna do OK. So GIMP aligned the layers. It took the, because we didn't care about the vertical alignment, we only did it in horizontal. So it took the right rightmost coordinate from the upper layer and leftmost coordinate from the lower layer and distributed all the layers in between linearly so that you get it aligned like this. So we could preview the animation by doing filters, animation, playback. Play this banner. Well, of course, we have some kind of a default setting for the delay for the frames that we didn't define. So I could either edit the comments here, or once we will export to the final GIF or MNG format, we'll ask for the default delay for frames that have no delay specified. So it's usually, if you have many of them, it's usually easier just to export and then, you know, define what kind of delay you want for the rest of them. So this is how the simple animation works. I forgot the frame that will say rock, but flat image. So that's the, oops. So that's the last. And I'm gonna do that last. I'm gonna do that 4 seconds.
Okay. So you basically do like, is it called brackets or parentheses?
Yeah.
Like the round parentheses, and with the delay, like some number in ms or milliseconds.
So that's how the simple animation works. You've noticed me actually having duplicates of the images because I would be editing the text and I had the frame. This the GIF format enables you to have like two ways of how the next frame interacts with the previous one. You have mode to replace or I think it's add or replace. Yeah. There's a different name for it, but it essentially adds the new artwork on top of
combine.
The previous, combine, to the previous image. So it wouldn't work if I would just have the text layers separately, because if I would want to use the replace mode, there would be no background. I would have to flatten it down to cover background and so it's sort of icky in a way. Once you learn the advanced way to animate, you'll see that it gives you much more flexibility. So we have this, it's still RGB color, so we probably want to index that. But before we do that, GIMP enables us to optimize the animation, which. What it essentially does, it creates the layers. You can see that all the mode is combined, so it always uses the previous frame, and every time, let me just... Unfortunately, in GIMP 1.2, you were able to quickly toggle visibility of a layer so that you would hide all the other layers. It's still not in the development version, but it will be there. No, you can't. It's there, okay, so it's there, so it works, okay, whatever, it works. So you can see that frame 2 now only includes this kind of garbled image, so it essentially deletes what was there, it becomes, you know, a little...
So it basically deletes everything that doesn't change between frames.
Yeah. So you, when you export that to GIF, you save space because only a few pixels changed, so... So that's right. Why you want to do this now rather than after you index the image, it's because you may want to like use Githering, which could be different on different frames if you would do it prior to the optimization. So you would have like all the blue gradient that we saw on different frames, it would be, you know, the Dithering would be a little different, so we would have a lot more pixels being changed. So the final optimization would, so the file would be bigger at the end. So I optimized this, and I'm gonna just index the way we're used to. Hopefully, no.
Just use the menu.
Yeah, okay, got it. So I would like to index that to at least. Okay, so I can preview, and this would be the final final banner that we created. So I can save that as MNG or PNG and use it in the browser and try that file save. Yeah. Okay. I want to save it as animation. Loop forever, and this is the default delay for the frames. But
so if you don't specify anything, it will use the one.
So if we have some kind of a browser here. And MNG should work. I don't know if I should try.
Well, we probably didn't compile the plugin.
Yeah, we probably need to lib MNG, you know, to have that available. So. But it's same. So that was the simple way. And now for something completely different, which is the. So maybe we should although I'm gonna enjoy that, we should just do some photo retouching. Or yeah. Are you more interested in photo retouching or animation? Animation? Okay. Anyone more interested in photo retouching? No? Animation? Okay.
Animation then.
Okay.
Sorry, dude.
My part is
Oh, I think we'll have time for that.
Well, you're going to use the other game anyway, so...
Oh, yeah, that's right.
You just switch to the other game, workspace.
Okay, so I need to go back to the old game, graphics. That. So the biggest disadvantage of the regular way to animate in GIMP is that you lose the functionality of layers being used for compositing a single image. So somebody called
you forget.
Never mind. I was supposed to give him, but never mind. You know, this guy. Created this cool hack, which is called GIMP Animation Plugins. It essentially means that when you work with an animation, you work with frames that are regular GIMP images with layers, paths, everything, and you have a sequence of them. Like, I don't know who from you attended the CinePane talk. They actually have a similar thing. They have like a sequence of file names that are named at a
like
special
image
way,
one,
yeah.
Image two, image three,
yeah. There's like a numbered sequence of them, And they have tools to jump around the sequence, you know, move to next frame and stuff like that. And they can alter any image, you know, loading it up. So GAP essentially works the same way. So if I have prepared something similar in samples to add advanced animation. So I'm going to create a new image. And it was 120. We have some nice gradients, balance, heads. No, we don't. So this, I would have that as, I'm going to do a really square banner. So I'm going to save that file, save as. Banner. I'm going to save that as frame. You really need to name your files to end up with this suffix, so that GAP names all the frames automatically. You can create new frames and jump around, but you really need to use this format. You need to use a native GIMP format, which is XCF. Don't use the stuff that I usually use, like compressing the files, which transparently didn't work here because we didn't have the Beezer plugin. So this is the file name that you need to save it in. It doesn't have to say frame, but you know, this suffix needs to be
something
there.
Something and write a number.
Yeah. So now I could, like, if I was, you know, not knowing all the functionality, I could create another frame and call it frame 002 and, you know, animate like that, and being able to use the layers functionality the way that I'm used to. But the GIMP includes a set of filters or plugins which are in the video section. So I can use something like duplicate frames. So I can duplicate a section of an animation, or even a single frame. That's the case in here. So I'm gonna do, like, if I remember what I tried to show you, let's say I'm gonna do a 16 frame animation. So I'm gonna duplicate the first frame 15 times. So I already, if I take a look at Nautilus, Uber, Guadex, samples, web, animation, and you can see there's already 16 images that include basically the same frame. I could, you know, use the go to next frame or previous frame functionality to work on a next frame, previous frame that you see. But I can also
set up a keyboard combination that there
yeah,
to like
yeah,
page
yeah,
up and page
yeah,
down.
So I could, like, do, I usually do this and this, so you can see that if I press next frame, GIMP would automatically save the file that I have opened and open up the other one. So it's really fast to move around. But also we have something called the navigator, PCR navigator. So it looks similar to the layer window, but it's actually for navigating the animation. So I can jump to a certain frame really quickly. I can also preview a segment. We don't have anything to preview yet, so I'm going to wait with that. Or you can, even if you have like a really big animation, you can set the time zoom. So if I would do this, I would only be shown some. Why? Okay, I would only be shown some frames. You know, because you get a certain like visual feedback from the thumbnails where approximately you're in the in your animation. So if you would have like 1,000 frame animation, this would be actually useful. Otherwise, it's usually the point of confusion, because when you accidentally choose this and then, where the hell did my frames go? So that's it.
So basically, GIMP swaps the image, like you have it open, and it loads the new one from the disk and swaps it in place of the old one. So you basically have an image, and it's like you can on the fly jump to the next one, and you still have all the layers.
Yeah. What I'm gonna do here is a little animation. I'm gonna have like a pulsating star, which will rotate as well, and then I'm gonna have a logo, GNOME logo, show up. It's gonna like scale, fade from alpha, like from being transparent, to, and I'm gonna also blur it. Unblur it. So it's gonna be blurry, transparent, and coming up, and it's gonna be beautiful. So, the key, of course, with this alone, you could be animating, you know, hand animating. The new, it would crash, but the new GIMP also has functionality called onion skinning, which is used by classical animators. So you could like see the frame below, previous frame and the next frame, and you could set the transparency. It would just create a new layer for you, and you could like, you know, see what the previous animation frame was. So you could like, you know, if you would animate a guy running, so you could see his position on the previous frame and on the next frame, so you could like, you know, paint the way you needed it. But it's not in this old version. So this would allow it be easy to create the animation that we create beforehand. You know, you could just, you know, edit the text and run to the next frame and have the same text layer editable, and click on it and change it. You know, this the thing that I did, like, you know, edited text, put this banner and saved it, duplicate it, move the flattened image to the next frame. While in here I would just have one frame, click on it, and it would say this frame, I would click on the second frame, edit the text, and it would be there. So it's really simple. So even for simple animation, I recommend using GAP, because it rocks. But you also have a very powerful filter that's called a move path. When you launch it, it looks a bit scary.
A bit.
Yeah, I actually had to, like, it was ages ago, Thomas had to walk me through it, because I was like, what?
And so, I just like barely understood it, so it was like, you click here, wait, no, that doesn't work that way.
Yeah, okay, so hopefully no accessibility, or actually hopefully some accessibility folks will be able to, Wolfgang Hofer is the guy, will be able to talk to Wolf. I've already like talked to him, and we added some icons to the stuff, so it's more clear, but it still needs a lot of love. So you have this this filter, which essentially enables you to take another image or animation and do stuff like move it around, scale it, rotate it, change transparency in time. So this is what we're going to use. So we have this source image combo, and I'm going to pick the glow. So the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to choose this little glow, and then we're going to just do it's going to be we're going to do a loop of the 16 for the 16 frames, a loop, and this glow will just, you know, shrink and then go back. That's the whole thing that it's going to do. So this is the source image that we're going to use. This is in case it was an animation, like for example, if I had an image with multiple layers, it's like the animation in the classical sense, the simple way. Each layer of the image is a frame of the animation. So I would have a multi-layered image. I could define a step mode for it. So For example, if I have these 16 frames and I have an animation which would have 4 frames, it could loop. So the 4 frames, when it gets to the 4th, it would begin on the 1st again. Or it would loop the other way, so not from the top image towards bottom, or the other way, I don't remember which way it goes. Or it would just go once. So for example, it would end up on the 4th frame, and all the next frames would still have the, I don't know if it would, probably would not have any other animation anymore. Then, once reverse, ping pong, which would go like from the first to the last, and then back, and then back. None, which would mean I have a source image which has got multiple images, and I would just want this one layer, no other stuff I want. And some other stuff that I don't really know what frame it is. Okay. So, but we only have one, so no matter what I set here, it's still gonna do the same thing, so just do once. When Thomas talked about layer modes, you can put this image into your artwork and set its overlay mode in here, but we're gonna use normal. This is the way that, you can see this nice little preview. This is the way it's handled. So for example, if I would leave it left off, this coordinate would mean top left corner of the glow PNG image. So if I would show you a preview, it would be like this, but I want something like center. So so this is the source image just placed on top of my image. You can see that I actually started on the frame 11. So Gap initially thought that I want the animation to last from frame 11 to frame 16, but I actually want it the whole way. This is just for the preview. This is nothing important for us at the moment. Layer stack. You can put this source glow PNG image anywhere in your stack. Of course, we only have the background layer, but for example, later on we're gonna want something to be put below some other layer. So you go from zero means the uppermost layer. So the more you increase this number, the lower it goes in the layer stack. Yeah, so we're gonna leave that. And points. So the animation, you can only work linearly unless you do it in a few steps. But we just want this thing to go, pulsate. So go from this size, shrink it a little, perhaps lower the opacity a little, and then go back. So we will need 3 points: the beginning, the middle stage, and the last point again. So what I'm going to do is
Add a point.
And you can see that I'm currently at the second point, so I'm going to go back to the previous point, which is the middle one, and I'm going to lower the opacity a little, not much, and I'm going to shrink it to 80%. Okay, so I can preview that, and it's going to look like that. Now I'm basically done, but because there's no undo on this functionality, because it really saves at each image, so you can't really go back, it's better to just have a preview if it's really what I wanted. So I clicked on the animated preview. I'm gonna want it 100% scaled, and I'm gonna do like the exact preview. So what it actually does, this preview, it does the final render. I just wanted to see it beforehand so I could cancel it for my actual animation. So you can see this is the whole saving thing that I wanted to create. So I want to apply it. can see it takes a while. You have to update the thumbnails. So we have the first step. We can use the navigator to actually preview. So it merges the individual images into one single image that has many layers. If you look at that. And we're already familiar with that, and it uses the same filter as we used before. So we see that. So that's the first step that we created. Then we want to use
layers deck now.
Yeah. So we want the same filter, which is video move path. I'm going to use the star this time. I don't know, magically change it to the star. That's what I want to use. This doesn't really matter. We're going to use center. 64, 64. And I'm going to use the layer stack because I actually want the stars to be below the... Oh, we'll see.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm gonna lower your opacity a little. I could even try some different modes or something like highlight. Oh, we can have highlights overlay.
You might want
okay,
to
yeah, that's pretty nice. Just
on
oh, yeah. Then.
Yeah. Maybe screen.
Well, screen wouldn't be good. So.
Well,
right. Anyway.
Well, that's pretty good.
And we want to okay, rotate it as well. So I'm going to add another coin. And I'm going to rotate it by 90 degrees.
45.
So I'm at the second point and I'm going to rotate it by 45.
45 probably wouldn't work because it's uneven in the
way.
Because of these points.
Yeah, there's yeah, it would
okay.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
That's because I started on the frame 11, of course. So that's why it's useful to preview your animation before actually applying it. It takes a while because it essentially loads up individual frames, puts some stuff on it, and saves it back, and loads another one. Yeah, probably. Exactly.
Poor machine.
Yeah.
Yeah, that looks better. That's what we want.
So we have this pulsating thing. So now what I'm going to do is, I think I'll need more frames than 16 to actually show the GNOME logo. So I'm going to duplicate this segment of the animation two more times. So I'm going to preview it one more time.
Should
of the data I already had in here. I just wanted to check if the loop is intact. Usually, the easiest way probably is to start and end at the same frame or at the same state, but have one frame more of the final animation and delete that one, so it goes into a loop and it doesn't skip on the last frame because it's the same state. So it would be twice there if you wanted to do an endless loop. But you don't really see it in here, so I'm just going to go with this. Yeah, so I'm going to duplicate the segment from frame 1 to frame 16 two times. So it's video, duplicate frames, and then from 1 to 16, do it two times. I hope it will do.
Let's look at it on the levels.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's essential. Yeah. Frames. Okay. So we have the base, and now I'm gonna do. I could just use the move path thing and do just blend and scale it up, and you saw that. But I wanna do the blur. I want to blur it it's blurred first and then it sharpens into the GNOME logo. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to use the filter all layers functionality. So I can apply any filter on each layer of an image, and I can even linearly change the values of the filter. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to duplicate the GNOME. I'm gonna first enlarge the canvas of the image a bit, because I'm gonna blur it, so it needs some canvas space. So I'm gonna change image canvas size to 128. That's another nice thing in GIMP 1.4. You could just have a button here that says center, so it's gonna center the image, and I don't have to do any complex math. Okay. So I'm going to use a layer to image size. Okay. So I have a nice little frame, and I'm going to duplicate it. And now let's see. I'm going to use. We have 48, so I'm going to use 48 frames. So I'm going to duplicate this thing 48 times. So okay, so I have it 48 times, and I'm gonna use filter all layers, and now I can select any filter. Some of them don't have the possibility to change the attribute or parameters of the filter in time, but most do. So I'm looking for plugin Gaussian blur this. Okay. Somehow the machine seems to be reading the disk all the time, so it's probably swapping. Maybe closing the other game will help.
It might, yeah. It's doing something. Well, the good thing with the advanced animation is that all your frames are always saved to disk.
Yeah.
So if your GIMP crashes, you at most lose just one frame.
Just a second. Yes, but the game don't say anything. No metacity, it's alive. It's just
I think it's just running out of memory.
Yeah,
because it doesn't have that much. I think it has 250 megs or something.
256. That's quite a number.
So well, maybe it's assigned to me.
Come on. Should have killed it.
Well, just point the enclosure.
It's closing it. Four in the military.
Yeah.
I'm gonna kill it.
I hope it doesn't kill the other one.
You need a bit of memory. I'm gonna choose apply bearing. Okay, so this is the lowermost layer. So I actually want that to be completely sharp, so I'm just not gonna blur it at all. And then I'm going to define the last one. So, which one would that be? Really?
Yeah.
Well, it's linear, so we really... this other one. I'll try 20.
Yeah.
So, now we have the animation, we could preview that, filters, animation, of course it's going to discard the alpha channel for the preview, but we don't care. Animation, going back, okay, so it goes like, of course you can see, it's clipped because it doesn't do alpha, so.
You get the general idea.
Yeah. Okay, so we have that, and we're going to use that in the... in our prepared animation, so we're going to use the same filter, which is
move pass.
We ran out of memory, so it's painful. Right? I'm gonna choose gnome. I don't really know if it goes from frame 1 to frame. This really sucks because. Gnome. It's actually 92. Okay. And we'll have it. Okay, so we have the frame. I think we want to go once reverse because I'm gonna go from the blurry, go down to the sharp one. We can, you know, see that. We can see that on the preview, so I may fix that later. So I'm just gonna use the blur and use opacity, so I can leave the handle top left because it's gonna fit preview. It fits. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah,
exactly.
So you
okay, well, that's a typical. Here. Yeah, that's a typical. In the original animation, I had all the layers. If you can look here, toggled invisible. So I would either wanna toggle them visible again, or to almost just show the force visibility, which will force all the layer visibility on the original animation. Okay, okay. So we have that. So I'll add a point. And we'll end up, we can see the preview frame on the camera at the venue. And once we left, I will show this frame. Maybe it's not intelligent enough. I'm gonna go back. I'm gonna go back to the previous point. I'm gonna lower the opacity a little, not much, but like that. And I'm gonna do spring. And I'm only going to run it. Okay. Let me make sure that I didn't forget anything. Center, did the day once reverse? Okay. Okay, and that should be our final animation. Hopefully. Once Unit finishes completing all the frames, which you can actually see what frame it's working on. You see, it's a bit of a hack, but it works. Okay, so what else would we need? So we have, how much time do we have?
That's a good question. I actually wonder when this is supposed to be ending. I mean,
well, probably
depends on your sleep level too. I mean, if you are still awake.
Yeah, we can do a little break before we do the photo retouching. We're supposed to go to 5:30 by
about
half an hour. So no break probably. I'll let you do. Or do you want
well, I mean, if you are all asleep.
Okay. I should have made the animation shorter. I think I'm not gonna apply it. When the preview is gonna be okay, I'm just gonna tell you that you have
that's
this kind of you have this kind of directory with all the image frames, and what you do is you use a filter called frames to image, which will copy. Merge all the layers in individual frames and put them together in one single image, which would have layers being frames of the animation. So it would end up having the same stuff as we did at
the
beginning,
animation.
The simple animation. And then you can do all the stuff like optimize the animation back and export that as GIF for animation, but also this can be used for like poor man's post-production or compositing software, because you essentially have a set of frames of your original animation, and then you can do stuff like move some object around,
and then you can export the whole thing as MPEG or AVI. It's got some backend to export to MPEG or Xanim backend for some other connects. Okay, so this is our little animation that we gave. So the older animation lives there, and we just had the blurred. Okay, so I'd be happy. I would just click. Well, it would be nice to show you the final result, but we should I? No.
Well, it depends. Then it's gonna.
It takes like a.
Just
how good.
We'll see.
Okay, so. So now GIMP is actually doing merging, putting our little animation into individual frames, and we'll end up with a final animation. It's going to be individual images, multi-layered, and we're going to use the frames to image filter to put it all back into a single image. And we're gonna optimize it. I mean, this is not really a banner because it's got 48 frames and the whole thing changes dramatically, so we will have like almost all the pixels different on individual frames, so you'll end up with a GIF of 2 megs minimum, so it's not really a banner type of thing to do. But I've done like a lot of more simple animations just using the video navigator and just editing text on individual frames, moving stuff around and but if you want to do something more,
it's like if you've seen the Xenian connector banner ad where there's like a skyline of a city. And then the lights turn on and it's like connect to Microsoft Exchange something. That's one of good examples.
Yeah, I was just painting. You created the skyline with all the lights turned on, and then I had a mask on the layer with the lights, and I would be painting on the mask on individual. So I jumped to frame number 2 and just painted a little so it would turn off some lights, and then go to frame 3, turn off some more lights, and then you can export to the final image that has the multiple frames. So you get more, it's again a non-destructive way of working, because you can go back and delete the layer mask on that particular frame. So it's really, okay, so we ended up. I can close this because that's our just a temporary animation that blurred our little logo.
Taking a while.
Then we close that.
I think I'm sweating memory somewhere.
No memory. No, I think, you know, it was loading up images.
I mean, yeah, there's a lot of data too.
So. Okay, so I'm gonna use the video frames to image filter. Okay, you can define the default delay. So I'm gonna do it a bit lower. I'm gonna do the whole animation that we created. We can like do some define the name and discard alpha and stuff like that. But I think this is all fine.
Basically, just click OK. It's gonna work. It's like advanced stuff if you want to.
Yeah, we didn't do anything with alpha. Yes, merge on the background color. So. Now again, it loads up every image of the animation and creates a new image that has individual images flattened onto into one layer of the final animation, and then we will
after slight wait we will get the final animation here. But it's actually, I mean, you could do the same by hand, like load a frame and do some stuff and save that, and then change the beat and save this like a separate image, and then do still some more stuff and then save it for as a third frame or whatever. So this is basically automating quite a bit of things that help you. So while it's not perfect, it's pretty useful for doing things like banner ads or whatever. This is really a low-end laptop, so it's if you have a decent machine, it's not this low really. It's just running out of memory.
Completely running out of memory.
Yeah.
You can see the progress bar at the on the image. Can't even move the cursor. Okay, I can. Okay. You can see the progress in there.
So,
yeah.
Well, just cancel it.
Nothing. I'm gonna.
If you can. Okay. It's like out of memory, so we'll see.
But I want to preview the final animation.
Well, yeah.
Actually, I think if I kill it and then load it up, it's going to be faster.
You think so?
I think so. I'm absolutely positive. If I manage to kill it. Okay, I think we ran out of
sweat. Right. I wonder if it had any sweat. I don't know.
Yeah, it definitely. Well, actually, yeah, it didn't have a prime size swapping as well. So.
Yeah.
The good thing with this is that you, like you saw, it doesn't lose your work because everything is always stored as separate files.
Ha ha ha. You shouldn't have said that. Because you can see, it didn't quite finish
writing everything.
Okay. So if it was finished, you know, we would just do frames, photos, and video, frames to image. Again.
Wrong image, yeah.
Which essentially is what I'll end up doing. I'll do it. Frames to image. I don't know, it was leaked in memory.
Something wasn't right, and then now it's even faster. Or it was a lot faster.
Okay, chunk. Okay. So we can filters, animation, and that. Unfortunately, we lost the overlay of the little logo. I'm not going to do that again. So so we have, you can see, we have what we had at the beginning. So I'm just going to set this last thingy, which had our little nice logo, 2,000, so that's 2 seconds. And I'm going to export that file, save as. Save the animation and okay, look forward and there. Okay, so we ended up having a internet watcher. It would be so sweet if we had enough memory here. Unfortunately, you know, the animation stopped in the middle, you didn't finish the, and then we had the 2 second last frame, so it's here. Now you have a nice little gnome 2 splash there, so too bad it didn't work out. But you get the idea that advanced GIMP animation is being done on individual images, enabling you to work with layers and have all the different layer modes, put in a single image, so rotate it, scale it, change
it. I'll sit there so
you
can
talk
what I
or you can even have a source animation, you know, and do stuff with that. So we had, for the ones that came, just came, we had an animation of a GNOME 2 logo being blurred, or it was blurry and sharpened and being still, so we used that as a source source animation, and we changed the opacity and in the at about 10% of the animation games it eat all memory and crash, so we didn't finish overlaying all the frames, so we would end up with a half animation that's not running in the browser. But you get the idea.
So now, again, for something completely different. Since many people have digital cameras these days, I hope this will be useful. So we're having some photo retouching stuff here, and one of the first useful things is the redye. red eye removal. So here's one of the main GIMP developers called Sven, and he looks a bit evil here with the red eye, which is, I think this is very familiar sight. Like, you get a photo with the flash, and the photo is really nice otherwise, but then you get this red eye problem. So GIMP has a way to turn on and off channels. So you see, when we look at here, the red eye problem, actually, you look at this green channel, it doesn't have the problem, so it's mostly on the red channel where you see most of the glow of the eyes is. So what you want to do is you untoggle these, so you will be only editing the red channel. And then basically what this thing is, I can do like, I'm again using the Alt trick, like this, and another one, Shift, so I'm adding to the selection, like this, and then Alt again, like this, and I might as well do like a little feathering, so it doesn't make sharp edges. Yeah, it wouldn't take out the, you mean the highlight?
The eye. You can see that you're overlapping the eyelid. So
yeah,
if
right.
You would, if you would do a bigger...
So let's play with this stuff still. So it's like... Let's see. So if I do like this, I can cut out the eyelid part. So if you do like Control Shift, you will see
it's changing
the intersection mode there. So you basically can define like a outer line for the selection. Actually, I messed up because the other eye.
But you can't do that.
Well, I can do it like even bigger. Like if I do, let's see, from here. Whoop. This might work, or it doesn't. Ah, forget it. I'm gonna do more with something else.
Just do it quicker.
Well, I'll just use group mask. This is a nice thing if you want to define the selection more. So you can use normal paint tools to actually edit the selection. So the selection is turned into this like red film, and you can paint on it with like normal paint tools, like with a brush. So you paint with black and it will remove the selection, and if you paint with white you can add to it. So we want to trim off the eyelid part here, so we just paint with black here, like this. So basically you are painting like as if you were editing the image, but then when you remove the quick mask, you see that you were actually editing the selection outline. So this is a quick way to do it. And now, the thing you can do is basically darken this thing, so you can use the fuzzy brush and paint black on the red channel only, which could help you with the red eye problem. Let's turn the selection outline off. So it helps a bit, although there's a little blue cast, so you might want to do the same on the blue channel. Whoop. Although there's another way to
just paint the gray, not the black, not the red channel, so there's a bit of a
yeah, we don't want to do it that dark, so we want to features of the build. Like this. I think that's pretty good.
Sometimes you end up having people with a little pupil. Actually, the people don't really have any iris on pictures like this because the pupil is completely open. So you only see the inside of the eye, the reflection in this, the red eye effect. So on some pictures, when there's not eyes big as this, you can't like reconstruct the iris manually by painting it, essentially, and then just doing small dots for the pupils. And it works really well.
Yeah, there's actually a quick trick if we just undo here. Let's see. This is where we started from. So if you just select the red channel, the new GIMP has this Dutch burn tool, and you can just use the burn to burn on the red channel. That should actually do the same trick. Like, let's see. It helps a bit too. So you don't necessarily need to do selections or anything.
Yeah, there's always multiple ways of doing things.
Yeah. And if you get like this, there's a blue cast on the highlight, then you can take a normal brush and, for example, paint with saturation mode and have black, so it will just paint with like gray. So it removes the saturation for the highlight of the eye.
So you want to do the contour quick, so you can just do the paint quick.
Yeah. So like this. So if you only paint on the red channel, you will not like lose too much detail of the eye, and you can still remove the red problem. So it looks pretty okay.
You have a good tool to do like whitening teeth.
Well, actually, you can use the Dodge tool for that, to whiten the teeth. The Dodge tool is much like whitening or darkening, but you can define if it works on the shadows. Like, if you paint black on an image, let's say here. Does it do anything? I might have. Yeah. So if I paint like this, it will just uniformly smear the paint everywhere. But if I use the Dutch tool or the burn tool, and I say only shadow should be effective, and I use the similar brush here, so you see it will only affect the dark areas. Or I can dodge, which is like the opposite. This is actually coming from the darkroom. Like, you know, when you used to develop black and white prints, the symbols of this icon are like this paddle, and then the burn tool is like a sheet of paper with a hole. So the original idea was that when you develop black and white prints in the enlarging thing, which projects the image on the paper, so while it would take like 30 seconds to develop, to expose the paper, you would, for like 5 seconds of that, wave this paddle on certain part of the image, so it would get less light. So you then could adjust the contrast. So that's the idea of this thing. So if we dodge, it means like we block the exposure, so it will lighten the image. And we say we want to dodge on the highlights here, and if we want to make the, let's say, the teeth nicer, so we can just dodge here on the... So how Pepsodent do you want it? So you see, it doesn't make everything white, it just whitens the white parts. So it's like pretty classy. This is really useful too for photographs. Like you can, if you have some.
There is a perfect filter for that, which is called Sparkle.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be like, or we can just use a brush, like let's say use this, and there's this diagonal star. And like, let's see. Like that. But anyway, okay. Off to the next then. We'll see.
Clone.
Yeah, the clone tool is another really useful. Like, we went to the Glendalough Monastery on the weekend, and I shot this really nice picture of the ruins here with the old window of, like, the wall of the church. But there's this tourist here, which is a problem of my nice picture. So.
Of course, Thomas could have asked him to move away, but then a group of Japanese people would walk
were rapidly approaching, so it would, the situation would have gotten like much worse if I didn't take the picture right away. So we have the clone tool here. And the way this works is basically you take a brush, like I, let's see, we take a big fuzzy brush again. So basically, you tell, you have this control key, you basically tell that we want to take this part of the image here, click, we mark this as the source, and then we want to copy it here to actually remove the person on the picture. And while you are selecting like clever spots, if your image has like the stone wall is pretty ideal because it has a lot of different kinds of stones and the surface looks like if you copy part of the stone wall here to another place, you don't really see like it's copied because it fits well. So we can take like part of here and copy it over here, and maybe like there's this horizontal part. So we copy part of this part here to here, and maybe like there's this gravestone, so we put one more here, and then we take a little smaller one, because we want to fine-tune things, so we want to get rid of these extra parts here, we don't really want to mess up the picture. And there was the shadow of the guy who actually doesn't exist anymore. So we can, for example, copy this part of this other gravestone here to get rid of the shadow. So basically, you pick up other parts of the image which looks right but doesn't have the problem object of the thing you are doing. So, or if you want to get rid of the gravestones completely, you can just clone like send from here, control click, and then just draw. So it basically just copies, you see the other crosshair there, that's the place it copies the pixels from to the other place. Like that. And then we take like from here and we copy it here. So there's no gravestone at all. Now we actually saw a bit of the original one because the source overlapped the actual part like where I was copying from. So I'll just copy a bit here and there. And well, we left the one here. Here's a little problem because we see like a half transparent rock here. So we can copy mark here. Like it's easy to take some distinctive like edge of stone and then align to that and then start like we click on the horizontal part here and then we continue from the horizontal part here. So then when we go on, it aligns with the rest of the thing. We copy from here to here. And the result is that the tourist is gone.
Do you still have a bit of a gravestone
This one.
This one.
Right, yeah. So we'll fix that part. Yes, you see there's some shadow left. So we can take, like, there's a brown stone here. So here's another one. So we control click here. And actually put it from that here. So we can kind of... The stone wall is pretty ideal for this. Like, you just pick another rock and then put it here. And if you have a fuzzy brush, it will just pretty nicely blend. So there. It's pretty nice. And the guy is gone. So the clone tool is nice. It's useful, like, if you want to retouch, or if you want to do crazy things, like, you want to... You have this guy and you want to have, like, many people there, so you just clone from another image and put some other guys there.
Reality selling guy probably might enjoy this for showing a building that has got three stores, while in fact it's cloned of one store, so you don't trust any pictures when you're buying houses.
Yeah.
Go check them first.
What else? Then actually I could do the
levels two on first.
Or
yeah, I'll do that.
Or maybe I could, well, if I do the perspective thing quick, and then you can do the rest.
In 2 minutes?
Well,
okay.
Yeah,
okay,
it's really quick. So the perspective thing, again, this is a little restaurant we found on the weekend. So I'm going to crop this a bit smaller. I'd like to have like a little sign on my own wall, like printed on paper and frame it. So,
are usually people doing 3D graphics that want textures?
Yeah,
they go around and shoot stuff, and usually like this one is not aligned, so they want the orthogonal.
Yeah, you want it to be straight. So the thing is that GIMP has this perspective tool, which you basically. You can like manipulate things like this, so it makes it puts things on an angle. But it has also this really useful backwards mode, which is basically when you define a perspective change, it actually does the opposite. So how it works here is that you take this. Image and you start to apply the transform and instead of like making a angle you actually align this grid which is originally like straight you align this grid to your image so we are aligning it to the frame of the actual sign here we try to do it as accurately as we can. So you see the squares or the
right.
Rows and columns match to the actual sign. The idea is to get it as straight as you can, like this, and then you transform. And since it's set to backwards, it will magically, if we did it right, it will magically align the thing. Pop. And you get it like the shadows on something might look funny because it was originally taken from an angle, but it will work really well, like to make things straight. Now you can just like crop this from here and you could print it out and frame it. Yeah. So the corrective perspective is really useful.
Yeah, the last thing that we wanted to show you were some tweaks of that you typically want to do with your image. Okay, so this is a picture that I actually took with my camera, and you can see it's got this. Well, actually, let me start with this one.
Yeah, this would have been a bit too bad camera.
Yeah, okay. So what we're going to talk here is tonal range. You take a picture,
like this one, and you see it's really flat. I mean, you would want to like boost the contrast, but okay, so you can see this is the histogram of the image, which means GIMP currently works only in, apart from the index mode, it only works in RGB color space. So you get three channels, red, green, and blue. And for each channel, GIMP, unlike the film GIMP mode these days called CinePane, which can work with 16 bits and above, 24 bit per channel, 32 even. GIMP can only handle 8 bit or 256 levels per channel. This gradient here shows all the range that individual channels can have. So if I look at the rack channel, you can see that minimal, this is the minimal amount of red, and this is the maximum amount of red. So you can see the distribution of individual levels of the pixels of the image. So you can see that there's almost no red pixels, dark red pixels, or you know, it's just a red channel of a pixel. So if I look at the whole value, then you can see that there's almost no black pixels on this image, which means that I'm actually wasting quite a lot of steps that could have been, you know, used while I was shooting the image, because all this space I have like this is 10%, which is like, you know, more than 26 levels of grays is wasted because I'm not using any of that. So I have this powerful tool called Levels, and I can tweak all these, so I can remap the input channel and remap that to the original full range of the levels. So if I do something like this, I would map, like this is the input levels and this is the output levels. So all the this area that wasn't being used is being actually this area is being used for the whole scale of the channel. So what it will introduce is gaps, but I will have like a full range of from completely dark pixels to completely light pixels. So it's gonna boost the shadows of the image, as you can see here. GIMP can actually do this automatically per channel. So I was doing this like for the composite of all the channels, but I could be doing it, you know, individually, or I can use the auto channels, which sometimes, like in this case, doesn't quite work because it introduces color cast, and we just kind of go back to value. Okay. So this was having a flat image. I could easily remap that. If I take a look at the histogram right now, it's using the whole range, the tonal range, but you can see that some at some levels I'm not using, that there's no pixels, if I would have like a sky or some gradient fluent transition between levels, it could create banding, because I'm only using 256 levels per channel, which, for example, if I would have a sky, which is something very light, and I would have like only a few levels for the whole sky, it could introduce, if I would stretch it like this, it, and you know, stretch the tonal range,
it would create steps of the sky. So I would boost the contrast or the difference between the shadows and the highlights. But I would introduce banding. So that's why film people need more color depth, because they want to tweak the images like this, but they need to have a lot more precision to be able to do that. So that was like fixing a flat brightness image. Another problem that's quite common is color casts. I have this image that was shot using automatic white balance, but somehow the electronics get confused and I got this totally bluish image. So I can use the same tool, which is called the levels tool, and I could go to the blue channel and I could decrease and also boost the other channels manually, and you can see it's kind of tricky, because I would, I could have introduced another color cast. I could make it reddish. You can see that I also changed the brightness. So GIMP actually has a new tool. You can see the color pickers in here that works on all channels, and you can actually pick, like, it works on the input channels as well. So if I would know that, this is really gray, I could pick the middle point of the channel, and it would change the middle gray to be the point that I clicked at. If I do that for the all channels, I'm actually making GIMP alter the color, overall color tone of the image, to reflect that I actually want to use, or I'm telling the GIMP that it is actually gray. So if I want to use this tool, I need to know on the image that there's some neutral gray on the image. And I just click on the gray area, and GIMP will automatically change all the other values to reflect that this really is gray. So it works like magically. You may need to alter the lightness a little, but that works kind of magically. So this is a new thing that was introduced in GIMP 1.4.
So basically, if you have a picture of a person with maybe the picture could, for example, have a white sheet of paper on the image. So then you know that thing is white. So you then choose the white point and click on the paper. So if the overall image is for example, yellow, which very often happens if you have normal light bulbs and you take a picture indoors, you usually get a yellow cast. So then you click on select the paper sheet at some white point. GIMP knows that, okay, that should be white, so it corrects the image.
Yeah. So it works perfectly for correcting color casts. But the problem, there's some nice things about the levels tool. First, you see the histogram, so you can easily, you see here, okay, the blacks, I'm wasting some information, because I'm not really having any pixels that are this black, so the blackest point now is some kind of a gray. But you only work with three levels. I have the shadows, the darkest points on the image. I have the highlights, and I have somewhere in between. So GIMP also has a tool. I might have a sample artwork for that. No? Okay, so let's use this. Let's use this.
Oh, I don't. I didn't have any sample artwork, unfortunately. But let's say I would want the snow to be, you know, have a really green tint, but have the shadows have some red tint. I know this is not a really real example, but I would have to search for an image that usually, like, the whole image is fine, but you would want to have, like, you have two dark, you have some really bright areas, and you have some really dark areas, and you want to, you know, lighten up the shadows, and perhaps not boost the highlights. Well, in the levels tool, you would do it, like, only have three points, while with the curves tool, which is here, layers, colors, curves tool, you can affect any part of the image. So you can see here, this is the input levels, and this is what I'm mapping it to. So for example, if I would want to introduce the really green tint to the light area of the image, I would add a point here to lock it. We don't really care about the shadows. We still want the thing to be intact. And I'm gonna boost the highlights to be really greenish. So I'm actually just affecting the highlights and not doing anything with the shadows. So I'm gonna just do the same thing. And I'm gonna boost the shadows. So I introduce blue cast to the shadows. So I'm effectively, you know, based on the tonal range, I can work on just highlights or somewhere in between. And you can see that when I click on the image, I can see where about on the tonal range I'm picking at. So I see, okay, the snow is really, really the brightest parts of the image, which of course I can see that. But if I would be like working on a channel, and perhaps it might not be that obvious.
So that's
okay. Another trick is that the fact that we only have 8-bit per channel is somehow limiting, especially when taking shots where there's a bright light source and then you have some shadows and you want to keep the detail in there. If you would, you know, be shooting pictures in higher color depths, then you wouldn't really care, because you would be using tools like this and you would just boost the shadows or bring up the shadows and lower the highlights. But it would introduce banding if we use just 8-bit per channel. So many cameras have got a feature called exposure bracketing, which enables you to shoot the same image, a set of images, like three images. One is underexposed, the other one is properly exposed, and the other is overexposed. Or you can do it manually, just, you know, fiddle with the exposure and underexposed one, then shoot the same image. You probably need a tripod.
You will definitely need it.
Or you can just put it on the table. Poor guy's tripod. Yeah. So you end up having three images with the same thing. So I'm gonna just take those. Okay, so I have a shot of a plant in front of a window, which has a light, strong light source, and then there's something that I can't completely, you can see something of it, but I'm like completely, it's complete darkness in here. So I'm gonna combine those three, because I have another one, which is this one, which for some reason looks also completely black to me, so I can bring it up.
Well, it shows a bit more.
Yeah, the gamma is... well, that's another thing. You probably need to have your output device calibrated before you do any of that. Let's forget that minor detail. So I'm going to combine all these into a single image. So I'm going to use the highlights from the darkest image, because you can see all the texture of the of the thing that I have on my Windows. And on the other hand, the most exposed, which is this one, light, does have the shadows, which I can't really see here, but let me quickly boost it. So, well, let's do it on the composite. So, I'm gonna combine all these into a single image. I'm gonna use the layer functionality. I'll start with the dark lightest. I'm gonna start with the lightest. And I'm gonna put medium on top of it. And whoops. The darkest on top of it. So I have a single image with all the three. I'm gonna name them to remember. This is dark and this is light. Light. Medium. And this is dark. Okay. So I'll start with the light one. So we don't really need shadows, highlights from this image. We only care about the shadows.
Did I say that right?
Yep. Okay. So we have levels. Actually, I'm going to use a crystal. Image, then layer, curves. So I will, however, boost them a little because they're completely dark. But I don't care. I don't want to add highlights. So I'm going to do something like that.
How does that look on there?
I will add even more by... Actually, I would start...
Let me undo. Let's start with regular. Okay. And I'll just boost the shadows here. Okay.
So when I was taking the picture, it would be like this, okay? You haven't seen me doing any tweaks on this one. So this is the lightest picture that we got. It's overexposed on the area where the window is, and it's got nice shadows in here. But they would still need a little boosting. So I'm gonna use a screen overlay mode, which is essentially like, in this case, double exposure, because I'm like, you know, boosting the lightness of individual pixels. I'm boosting the luminosity of the one below. So what it did is it did it flat,
like
linearly for all the tonal range. So even the highlights get boosted, which we don't want. So I'm gonna just do it for the shadows. So we got proper shadows in here. You can see I put a battery in here so we can see something in the shadows. But the window is completely overburned, overexposed. So I'm gonna use this one, but we're gonna only use the highlights from this image. So I'm gonna do exactly the opposite thing. I'm gonna use something like this. So we don't care about the shadows, but you can see that if we have the normal mode, then we essentially all the pixels are opaque, so they. Are shown instead of whatever is below them. So I'm gonna use effectively the inverse function or layer mode than what we used before, which was screen. which is multiply. So the
actually we should tweak it a little more because of what it actually affect.
So we're taking the basically dark highlights from the dark image, so that's highlights. We take shadows from the one that's overexposed, and we boost it even with the one that was in between. So that's the shadows, and also we take the middle point.
Shadows, highlights, and something in between
from the two, and then we overlay the last the highlights from the darkest image that we got. So we essentially overcome the limitation of having only 256 levels per channel. So if we would work on a single image properly, I couldn't really, with the camera that I have, expose this shot properly, because I would either get the shadows or get the highlights. I couldn't get it all at the same time. And if I would use the curves tool on a single image, I couldn't still get this. It wouldn't be there simply. I mean, the camera only records a JPEG, which uses RGB with 8-bit per channel, so if I would do concentrate on the shadows, then the highlights would be overexposed, and that would be it. There wouldn't be any. That would be like four levels for the highlights. So I would get, if I would alter that, I would definitely get banding, because there would be just four levels for all the highlights, or the same thing for shadows.
So in other words, it would look like crap.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
F11 and tab.
Okay. And the last thing, if you're still wanting to listen to us, is sharpening. That's another problem. You have an image.
You need to have an image to actually get the other.
If you have an image, an eye is really very sensitive to luminosity and crispness. So if you have an image that's not properly sharpened, or you even shoot an image at very high resolution and then you scale down with some interpolation, it gets slightly blurred. So you end up having a blurry image, and you want to fix that.
Phase one. And I have photo retouch sharpening. Okay. So let me do this one.
Original.
Original.
Okay. So I have this image. You can see that apart from the fact that it it's a bit blurry, or not sharp properly. It also has this CCD noise, and it's completely unfocused at the background. You could be using, for sharpening, there's a filter called Sharpen.
And change.
Enhance and Sharpen. But you can see that it actually sharpens the noise as well.
Boost it, like overdo that to show you.
Yeah, you can see that it would really boost the noise as well. So it's not really useful. I mean, we could show you how to clean the noise out using something called selective Gaussian blur, which is really an awesome filter, but it takes really long to compute, and I really want this image to have this noise to show you proper sharpening. So what we're gonna do is we're gonna use a filter called Unsharp Mask, which actually sharpens the image, although it has a name that would imply something else. And not only that, because even if we use, I'm using a selection, so it's computing faster and have a preview. So Unsharp Mask, which is here, Enhance Unsharp Mask. So I'm going to use 10 pixels. Unsharp Mask actually works on the contrast edges. You have some lighter area and darker area, and Unsharp Mask visually, like I'm just describing the final effect of the formula behind it, lightens the light areas towards the edge, towards the border of the two areas, and just the darkens the dark areas. So you end up, like you can see in this, well, let me do a nice little demonstration. If I have a hundred pixels image, and I fill it with gray, and fill half of it with white, and I apply the filter, you can see that, well, you can't go lighter than white, but on the dark side, it actually created a gradient towards black. So it like if you look at older black and white films, you can always see the edges are being exactly the same way. The dark areas are actually very dark on the edges. Visually, for the eye, the whole thing looks sharp. So if you look at that, all the edges have been boosted, and it really looks sharpened. I have this other image, which I'm gonna publish. I'm gonna use this Muad'Dib samples photo retouch sharpening original. So you can see that it comes out. I overdone it a bit, but you can see that it really darkens the dark stuff and lightens the light edges, and it comes up and it looks really sharp. But it also, let me go back to this one, it also did the same thing for the noise. So the noise looked like there's edges, and overall it's not really optimal. So what we're gonna do is we're gonna work only on the edges. So we're gonna apply the filter only on the edges of the image. And also, you can see that the CCD noise is not linear across the channels. So you have red dots elsewhere than the green dots and the blue dots. So we're gonna only work on the luminosity, because there's a possibility to decompose an image into individual channels. But apart from supporting only RGB, GIMP also can do other color models, and one of them is HSV, hue, saturation, and value. So we're going to use the value channel to do all the sharpening, so we don't affect the color channels. So we don't do anything with color, because you can see that it actually boosted the contrast as well, saturation as well, and changed the overall image. So the first step is going to be to split the image into channels, which is filters, color, and I'm going to do decomposer channels and HSV. Okay. So you can see this is the hue, saturation, and value channel. And this is the channel that we're going to work on.
So so the value channel is basically a black and white version of the original image.
Yeah, essentially. Well, there's multiple ways how to get a grayscale image out of a color one, but this is one of them. I could work on a quick mask, but for you to see better, I'm just going to create a copy of the image, of the layer. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to just find the edges, because we want to sharpen just the edges. That makes the image look sharp. We don't want to sharpen, you know, the blurry thing at the back. So there's a filter called edges or edge. Okay. So this found us some nice edges, but I'm gonna use the levels tool again. Colors. Levels tool. And I'm gonna discard all the in between, like the gray pixels, because I don't care about those. I'm actually wanting just to create a mask or a selection that creates the contour of the edges. So I'm not caring about anything else but these. And you can see that there's another way. There's a filter called threshold, but it only does one bit stuff, so you would end up having either white pixels or black pixels, and if you use the levels, you can still have a grayscale.
So it would also look crap.
Yeah. Okay. So, but we don't want those, so I'm going to just use the airbrush, and I'm going to airbrush this thing. Or I could use the selection tools and get rid of that.
Yeah, there's many ways to do things.
Yeah, so.
But here's one good way to use the selection tools.
So essentially, so I have the edges of the image. Now I'm going to use that as a selection. So the fastest way to do that, I could have done this already in a quick mask, but you wouldn't see it properly. So I'm going to select all. I'm going to copy that. Copy. I'm going to hide this thing because we don't need it. And I'm going to toggle selection to a quick mask. And I'm going to paste. Yeah. So I could have done the whole thing. I could have pasted the original image here and done all the edge detection and the levels right here, but you wouldn't see it properly, so I did it in another layer. And I actually, before changing that to selection, which would look like this, I'm gonna blur it a little, which is an alternative to feathering the selection. But I'm gonna grow it like a pixel or two. I'm gonna grow it by one pixel and feather it. Okay. So while I have the selection active, I can just hide it so you can see the result of the filter while I apply it. But it's still there. Show selection. And apply the sharpening, which is filters, enhance, unsharp mask. Okay, so this will be like 5 pixels, 4 pixels, and I'm just going to do GC. Okay, so you can see that with a sharper image, I can go back, Control Z, and Control R. You can see the difference. This is the unsharp version, and this is the sharpened one. And then I'm going to compose the image back. So I'm going to use filter, colors, compose, and I'm going to use HSV again, hue from the hue image, saturation from the saturation image. And I created two two backgrounds, so we use the background. Okay. Ta-da! So we have the final image. Like this. I can apply the same filter on the original, and duplicate it, and apply it so you can see the difference. Filters, and enhance, unshort mask, same thing. And you can see we brought up the noise of the background, and this is the original. So I'll try to fit them on the screen somehow.
You can just put them like as two layers and you can switch them one or another.
Okay, so this is original. This is the original, which is uncharted. It's gonna look like that. This is the fast way, so you can see it did sharpen the object, but you can see the noise came up as well. And this is the proper way, so we didn't do anything with the noise, including the face. You know, there's no noise being sharpened here. It may be, if I do it quickly enough, I can show you on a nice little image. Do this one using the filter. Okay, this one. Okay, so I'm gonna go back, and I'm gonna it kind of changed the structure of the menus. It makes sense now that it means. Colors, decompose, some time to get used to. And take all that, copy it to channel, enter, and do edge detect, filters, edge detect. Levels. Filters, color, compose, HSM, original is new, saturation, and value. Okay. And we have a perfectly sharpened image compared to the uncharted one. There's the original. Okay. Maybe not on the projector, but okay. Take some shrink. Gamma correction. Okay. Can you actually see anything?
Maybe not.
A difference?
Well, okay, yeah.
you can see that this jumps out of it. And you know, none of the background is being affected, so you really have the object of the shot that you bring up in the image. So
that's the proper way to
sharpen objects.
I guess we are reached to the anyone have questions stage. So the official part of the thing is over, but we'll be glad to answer questions.
Tasks? I mean, how to you were struggling with something and you know how to do that, and we can figure out something.
Like, I mean, it could be something really simple, and there are no stupid ones, and you know.
If you want to ask, we can try to figure
another
out
thing would be things. Like the selected version where for removing noise.
It's been a long while.